Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. We're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for the last day of August, the 31st, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hello, Melody, and happy Touch a Heart Day. It's also National Trail Mix Day, National Eat Outside Day, and most importantly, Love Litigating Attorneys Day.
Oh, yeah, that's one to celebrate,
isn't it? Yeah,
geez. Yeah, all right.
Yes.
We're going to write those off.
Now, on this day, by the way, in 1997, Princess Di died when her car crashed in a tunnel in Paris. Mm. But perhaps even more sinister, in 1868, the body of Jack the Ripper's first victim was found in London's East End.
Hmm.
There you have it, my trivia for the day. Aren't you glad you asked?
Absolutely. I'll make notes of that. So next time I'm asked, I will know. You know, it's interesting, though, when I was in Paris and we had this tour guide and he was taking us around Paris and so forth for the day. And we're going down into this underpass. And he said, oh, this is where Princess Di died. Wow. It's like, really? This is a tunnel? I envisioned, you know, with all the news reports and things like that, I always envisioned a long tunnel.
Yeah. What is it? Just a little
underpass? It's not like an underpass.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was shocked, you know, maybe a little bit longer than a regular underpass, but
yeah.
By no means would I have.
What was above it? Did you see? Was it a pedestrian walkway or a little road?
I think it was a road.
Yeah.
It was a road. I wouldn't have thought of it as a tunnel. I think of it as an underpass, but
yeah, that's there's a distinctive difference, at least in this country.
In this country, so yeah, and then I thought to myself, how in the world did it happen, man? Well, I think we all know the answers to that, but anyway, do we know the answers to gold today? It's up 480 is the question, and it's supposed to be much, much higher. But we'll take up $480, $1,816. Silver, it was up for most of the day, holding at $24. Platinum was up $8 at $1,019. Palladium was down $32, $2,559. The USDX today was down 0.02 at 92.67. Crude oil was down 71 cents at 68.50. Paper markets today, they fell slightly. The Dow was down 39 points, 35,360. The S&P was down 6 points at 4,522. NASDAQ was down 6, also at 15,259. Europe was negative across the board, just barely, just a couple digits like ours. However, Asia, they were strong overnight. Most of them were up over 1%. Looks like the Shanghai was up the least, only at 0.5%. Let's see what the bond did. 10-year yield, 1.31%. It's kind of been holding there, dipping a little bit, but coming back to that 1.31. It's been there for a week or so, for the most part. And so, can't really say anything else that's going on. Dave, would you like to add anything?
No, I don't think so.
Market report before we get started?
Nope.
Well, let me tell you.
What?
Well, I'm going to tell you. Consumer confidence, the one that puzzles me the most. But it did fall. It dropped to a six-month low in August. And, of course, again, it's all because and concerns over the Delta variant. Something more important, I think, is rising inflation. Kind of weighs on the American's view of the economy. now and what's going to happen in the near future. The conference board's index fell to 113.8 from a revised 125 reading in July. That's a big drop. That's a big drop. The figure suggests the spread of the Delta variant has dented customers' views. I think it's more of the economy, period, and inflation. Because really, you know, with all this debacle with Afghanistan and so forth, there isn't a whole lot. There's not a big push anymore on the mainstream media's about the virus. Now, maybe back in earlier August there was, so it might have given more cause for concern from most consumers' views. But we do have restaurants. They have issues with reservations. We've seen issues with airline travel and hotel occupancy. We also have Americans paying more at the grocery store. Americans are paying more at the gas pump. And, of course, that certainly has some sort of an impact on that sentiment dropping as significantly as it did, Dave.
Yeah. You've got the conference board's economist, chief economist Lynn Franco, who said concerns about the Delta variant and to a lesser degree rising gas and food prices resulted in a less favorable view of current economic conditions and short-term prospects. The board's gauge of current conditions fell to the lowest reading since April at 147.3. Consumers' view of present business conditions declined. Economic expectations dropped to 91.4. It's a seven-month low. Consumers were less upbeat about their future income and job prospects. The share of consumers who said jobs were, quote, plentiful, eased slightly from a multi-decade high the prior month. But consumers said they were somewhat less likely to purchase cars, homes, and appliances in the near future. Vacation plans for the next 6 months, however, did edge higher. So there you have it. The zigzag and up, down, and all around of consumer confidence. It's really quite the bizarre Nick signal bag.
It certainly is. And, you know, we all know what's going on in Afghanistan, the wind down and so forth. Many, many Americans left behind, even after the president has said no American will be left behind. It is such a travesty what's going on with that. It's hard to believe. I mean, when President Trump was trying to make a treaty with the Taliban, it's like, well, how's that going to work? It's not going to work. And it's not going to work when you have this administration thinking that they're going to work with the Taliban in getting the releases of the people that are left behind. And there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes that not a lot of folks know about, you know, unless you listen. They are killing people over there. They are beating up people over there. They are doing things to those that are left behind. For Lord's sake, they got the list of people's names. And people did try to make it to the airport. But the gates were locked. They wouldn't let them in. I mean, and it just really is amazing that there's no way that the Taliban is going to be working with the U.S. I mean, it's like, what are they smoking in D.C.? Now, if it's true and it actually does happen, well, then I will give credit where credit is due. But there have been over 90 retired military generals and officers who are requesting the resignation of two of the people that were in control of this evacuation. And Dave, it's just, and yet I can see where people think they should applaud this administration for getting out the people. And it's just like, what don't you see? what don't they see? I mean, and it really is. It's interesting. That's how divided this nation is. And I read an article today, Dave, by Pat Buchanan, and he was talking about, you know, once before when we had a similar situation with Kennedy, the nation came together. We were together. We actually, he blundered, but we came together and supported because we were a nation as a whole. And we don't have that anymore. And it's sad to say we don't, Dave.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure we ever did. I think we're just more aware of it now with 24/7 news cycle and just the corporate domination of particularly television news, but also print media and big tech's control of social media. But you know, that's probably the topic of an entire program. For now, I mean, the planes have essentially stopped rolling in and out of Kabul. But I read a story this morning that said once the U.S. and U.K. and a couple of the other Western nations finalize transporting these refugees to their, quote, final destinations, that they will circle back and try and pick up the folks that have been left behind. But there are all sorts of problems.
But they're going to circle back and just pick them up at a normal airport? We're not allowed into their airspace.
Well, that's...
And that's if they're alive.
Well, that's... Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of ifs. And I mean, most importantly, it depends on the cooperation of the Taliban. And you know, who among us that is sane thinks that's even a remote possibility? Now, the Taliban can't be too gung-ho. They're going to find themselves under constant drone strikes for the next 6 months. And, you know, they don't want that either. Although, you know, I'm certainly not advocating for that, but it's certainly a tool that the U.S. And our allies have at our disposal, particularly if there's wanton killing of Americans and other Western citizens.
Yeah, but the whole thing, and you know what? The sad thing is, Dave, those Americans shouldn't have been placed in that situation. And it's all, you know, it's all quarterbacking and so forth. But someone should be held accountable.
Well, listen,
someone needs to be held accountable.
I'm not sure I can agree with you there because the vast majority of people who were there went on their own volition voluntarily. Now, there are, that's, you know, whether or not, I mean, if you're arguing, should have we been there in the first place, you know, I don't think we should have been, or if we should have been, we should have been out of there years ago.
We should have been.
After the initial
mission. But that's not the discussion. The discussion
was fulfilled.
But the point is, there were Americans left behind. And your own president had said, we will not leave any American behind. And the whole thing is, from what I've heard, and I've listened to a lot, if they would have started earlier and been smarter about it, but someone needs to be held accountable. Because it wasn't done in a manner, and there's no need to rejoice. We've had 13 lives taken, lost. It's someone needs to be accountable for it.
As I recall on Saturday, the president before the cameras said, the buck stops here.
Yeah, well, so then he should resign.
Oh, come on.
He should resign then.
Come on, geez.
What?
That's
or he should be impeached.
Oh my God, gee, that now you go from silly to crazy. That's not true. Yes, it is.
What's the difference? They impeached Trump
Multiple crimes. Are we going to revisit that? Let's not go there.
Well, on a phone call, basically.
No, that's what you'd want to believe. I think your memory has all of a sudden gotten short. But
I don't know, Dave. Maybe you need to read a little bit more.
But
anyway, let's go on. And you know, the Dallas Fed Manufacturing Index, that fell sharply, and that came out yesterday. It fell to 9.0 in August from 27.3 in July. Pointing to the smallest growth in factory activity since January. Now, this production index, which is a very key measure of state manufacturing conditions, that slipped 10 points to 20.8. The new orders index came in at 15.6, down from 26.8, but then more than double the series average. So perceptions of broader business conditions continue to improve in August, though the indexes came in markedly lower than they had in recent months. So everything remains optimistic, of course. How else would it be? Through the Future General Business Activity Index, even though it was less positive, falling fairly steeply from 37 to 15, Dave.
Well, the Dallas Fed Index is known as an important indicator, as the state produced $159 billion in manufactured goods, roughly 10% of the country's manufacturing output. Texas ranks second behind California in U.S. factory production and is first as an exporter of manufactured goods. So just one of the reasons, you know, each of these regional manufacturing surveys, you know, has its own purposes for being the indicator of the national economy, as each of them is.
Well, you know, they're already trying to downtalk the Hurricane Ida, the impact on the economy. But Dave, how when you have New Orleans reports of being closed down for a month?
Beats me.
I can't see how they cannot imagine that it would be limited, to be modest, the economic impact. So I don't know. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter. And let's see, where are we at, Dave? I think I lost my notes here. Why don't you go ahead and start the next segment, Dave?
All right. Well, it's early in the new week, and we now know that Jerome Powell isn't in a hurry to dial back loose monetary policy anytime soon, because he doesn't want to cause lasting harm, in his words, to the economy. With the economy progressing easily as it's been, everyone wants to know when the Fed's going to start tapering its monthly purchases of $120 billion worth of bonds. You know, that's the emergency policy kicked in last March. It was meant to keep interest rates low and the financial markets liquid during the pandemic. Here we are over a year later, year and a half. It's going strong. Now, speaking virtually at the Kansas City Fed's Economic Policy Symposium on Friday, Powell repeated his recent position that the Fed could begin to taper its asset purchases by the end of the year, emphasis on could. He stopped short of formally announcing the timing and pace of that taper, in line with what a number of economists and other observers like us were broadly expecting. I'll spend a good deal of Friday's speech explaining why he thinks the forces that are driving up inflation in recent months are still, yes, transitory, temporary, in Fed speak. At one point, he even warned of the perils of dialing back loose monetary policy after misreading inflation signals, a discussion that multiple Fed-watching economists have characterized as dovish.
Well, you know, if a central bank tightens policy in response to factors that turn out to be temporary, the main policy effects are likely to arrive after the need has passed. This is also what Powell had said. Then he also added that the ill-timed policy move unnecessarily slows hiring and other economic activity, and it pushes inflation lower than desired. I mean, you know, he's beginning to sound a little bit like all the rest of them. It's just a bunch of how they think they can control everything. And it really is kind of, you know, how much control do they really have left, Dave? You think?
Well, they have less than they think they do and more than they should.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And therein lies our concern.
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's going to be in a couple of months, the world top trade ministers are going to meet in Geneva with the goal of rebooting an institution whose rules oversee global trade flows.
Where are they going to meet again?
Geneva.
I like that.
You like that? I don't know why, but.
It sounds peaceful.
Where else to go to give it to the world, you know? Anyway, this is all to reboot the WTO. And, of course, the overseas global trade flows worth about $22 trillion annually. So supposedly there is much at stake for the WTO. Of course, it has failed to reach any multilateral agreements for the better part of the past decade and lost its ability to fully settle trade disputes affecting billions of dollars in global commerce. The WTO says its November ministerial conference could help reverse that trend by providing an opportunity for governments to deliver real outcomes that impact the lives of everyday people. So for those of you who ever think that globalization is going to stop, this is just not going to happen. Switzerland is in the midst of a fourth wave driven by the Delta variant. New cases have risen to levels last seen in January. And the Swiss government mandated teleworking and forced all non-essential shops and restaurants closed. So there you go, Dave.
There you have it. Well, their director general, Ngozi Iweala, remains
easy for you to say.
Indeed, indeed. He serves as the WTO's top negotiator. He remains undeterred, supposedly, and is keen to hold an in-person conference. She's doing this because she knows a busted conference would signal to the world that the WTO is not capable of delivering at a critical moment for the global trading system. I don't know where we go with this melody. In theory, this was perhaps still is a good idea, but most of the countries are doing pretty gosh darn well negotiating multilateral deals on their own without the WTO. So I don't know, how much time, for example, our country is going to want to spend. Department, U.S. Treasury, trying to rebuild the WTO, particularly its dispute settlement system, which, went awry in the past 4 or 5 years. But I guess we'll see come November what particularly the industrialized nations, the G7s, the G20s, or to what extent their commitment level is going to be there to make this organization work again.
Mm. Well, if you missed it, incomes got a sizable boost in July. Nominal personal income grew 1.1% to $20.7 trillion during the month. July's hiring spree and expanded child tax credits drove that growth. So it's all, again, government stimulus that makes the economy go, nobody on its own. The latest form of aid, which began mid-month, it's going to run through the end of the year. So extra unemployment benefits are ending, and because consumers pulled back on spending last month, the stashed away sums will translate into future economic growth, Dave.
Well, disposable household incomes rose for the first time since March to $18 trillion, while consumer spending growth slowed in July, and that they say is helping savings to continue to grow, which has grown a lot during the pandemic. Because incomes outpaced spending, however, personal savings climbed $1.7 trillion, which translates into a personal savings rate now of 9.6%. That's real high. If you look over the last 20 years. Now, Oxford Economics said in a statement, while the expiration of unemployment benefits come this weekend, actually, and the absence of another round of checks to families will weigh on income growth in 2022, the ongoing child tax credit and rebounding employment, along with wages, should support households next year. Wow. On their own, Melody. Can you imagine
Oxford added, we believe cooler consumer spending growth is more likely than consumers retrenching and the economy going into reverse.
Well, this is a topic that will be kept short. Hospitals, drug companies, health insurance, medical device manufacturers, and other healthcare suppliers, hey, they generated record sales and profits during the second quarter. No surprise there. Not when you get billions and billions of dollars. I don't know how much the government has given them for all the vaccines and so forth, but we don't have to pay for any vaccines. So I guess the government does. Billions of dollars. So they should be making a pretty good profit. And, you know, they've got stimulus, they got bailouts to offset the decline in patient volumes. Hospitals, nursing homes, other providers received federal bailout dollars. So why shouldn't they be flush with cash and profits on people's illnesses? Pharmaceutical companies saw some sales dip, but pharmacy prescriptions and infusions, hey, they picked back up. So the industry maintained a 9% profit margin on much higher revenues compared with the second quarter of 2020. So, Dave, anything you'd like to add?
Nah, it just gives me agita.
And how about this? I haven't heard anything about IKEA in years, Dave. In years. But IKEA is piloting a furniture buyback and resale program in the U.S. as it aims to make the service a permanent fixture at its stores nationwide. Now, this is a pilot program that will be available in its stores in Philadelphia from Monday, September 19th. It will eventually roll out to other additional markets. Now, they have launched repurchase programs in other countries, including the UK, as it works towards making its business a little bit more sustainable and climate positive by 2030. Loyalty customers will be able to sell their gently used furniture in exchange for store credits. The items will then be available for resale in the retailer's as-is section at discounted prices. Any customer can join the loyalty program for free. Fully assembled furniture will be assessed based on its condition, age, and functionality, but some categories of products like dressers will not be eligible for the program.
Yeah, clearly a program intended for young adults, maybe perhaps even teenagers. Recent survey in the spring from Piper Sandler found that 47% of teens are purchasing secondhand goods, 55% have sold secondhand. Now, IKEA joins Gap, Macy's, Penney's, and J. Crew, partnering with the resale platform ThredUp to test this secondhand market. Be interesting to see if this concept has staying power. Be looking forward to seeing what we read about this. I guess they're looking for any way to keep the doors open these days, Melody.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If anybody has tried to resell or sell their furniture, you can't find buyers for it. Nobody wants to pay anything for it. So I can't imagine how successful. I mean, if it was successful in UK, I mean, it's a little bit of a different system over there. I mean, people can go out and buy new stuff. Why do they want to buy used stuff? It really is amazing. I can't tell you how many people have told me that they've been trying to sell furniture and nobody wants it. Nobody wants used stuff anymore. So I don't know. It will be interesting to see how that works here in the States. You don't see so many used furniture stores anymore in your strip malls or anything like that. I wonder though, if they take that, because if the people get credit and IKEA gets the store, they don't get money, they get credits. Well, so they can purchase something else. So if IKEA gets to donate the furniture that they can't resell, I can't imagine it would be a lot of money, but they'd be able to get write-offs for it, I would expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
I guess every little bit helps for write-offs, but I don't know. I can't imagine it would be billions of dollars. Well, I think maybe millions.
Yeah, well, to the extent they they have anything to write off against.
I thought this was very interesting. China to limit minors to 3 hours a week. Kids under the and teens under 18 years old in China will only be allowed up to 3 hours per week to play online video games. The move is a fresh blow to the country's gaming giants from Tencent to NetEase, which have dealt with an onslaught of regulation this year in areas from anti-monopoly to data protection. And now this has spooked investors, of course, as has wiped out billions of dollars of value off these Chinese tech stocks. So now, according to a translated notice about the new rules, people under 18 in China will be allowed 1 hour a day between 8 p.m. and 9 p.m. on Fridays through Sunday and on legal holidays to play video games. The agency billed the rule as a way to safeguard children's physical and mental health. The rules will apply to companies providing online game services to minors, limiting their ability to serve those users outside of designated hours. The companies will also not be allowed to provide services to users who haven't logged in with their real name registration, and so on and so on. So, hey, what do they do to you if you watch 4 hours?
Well, there you go. That's the big question. Do they knock on your door and take away your PlayStation 5? You know, do they come in and take your laptop, your Wii's? I don't know.
Probably punish the parents.
Well, there's the other thing.
Hey, I'm the first one who says our kids have too much access to video games and internet as much as they do have. But it is something also when you have your government coming in and saying, hey. So again, it's just another sign. And it'll be interesting with all their social scaling, how all that works into play. Will those who have a higher rating be allowed to have more hours or less hours? So
probably.
Yeah, so anyway, you're government controlling. It's an idea. And not much different from Twitter and Facebook, is it? We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk talkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
One more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody's in the office this segment. Call her at 1-800-375-4188. Our weekly American Survival newsletter came out last evening. Listeners can subscribe to our free newsletters and blogs at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, or you can read them on our Facebook page at dgscoins. That's the at sign, dgscoins, one word. Now, late yesterday afternoon, Amanda Macias of CNBC News spelled it out with these blunt words. The war in Afghanistan is over. But is it really? I mean, I'm not so sure her assessment will pan out, at least not right away, but more on that in a little bit. Commander of U.S. Central Command, U.S. Marine Corps General Kenneth McKenzie, reported that the last C-17 military cargo plane left Karzai International Airport in Kabul on Monday there with no Americans aboard, and that final aircraft jet stream fading into the stratosphere, the U.S. wrapped up. It's dysfunctional and some say criminally neglectful evacuation efforts. In any event, it effectively ends America's longest war, 19 years, 11 months, and 346 days, based on passage of the Senate Joint Resolution on September 18, 2001. In other words, let the power vacuum begin. I'm sure that in the coming days, weeks, and months, virtually every news outlet and podcast host around the world will offer their postscripts and postmortems on the, quote, war, what went right, what went wrong, and what happens next. Indeed, even before the last American forces were out of Afghanistan, in fact, I believe a few hundred are remaining behind for now, China and Russia were working the geopolitical chessboard to determine their next moves. And neither country does so without potential major consequence. As Macias's colleague Sam Meredith observes, the unfolding crisis in Afghanistan poses substantial risks to Russia and Central Asia, even as the Kremlin seeks to claim a propaganda victory over the U.S. Russia's response to the Russia's response to the recent and sudden Taliban uprising appeared to celebrate the defeated American-backed and trained Afghan government, as well as the U.S.'s departure. Russia's ambassador to Kabul praised the Taliban, saying the insurgents had helped to make the capital city safer in the immediate aftermath of the U.S. exit. And that's despite Russia having officially recognized the Taliban as a terrorist organization. Strange bedfellows indeed. But foreign policy experts like Kate Mallinson at Chatham House say Russia is expected to try to further exert its influence as a key backer of security in the region. Macias observes that Moscow has important military and economic sway over key former Soviet republics, such as Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, all of which directly border Afghanistan. Last week, Russia
quietly started its own evacuation plan, sending four military planes to remove 500 Russian citizens and those of its regional allies. Now, the Putin directive is said to have marked an abrupt shift in the Kremlin's position on the Taliban's takeover. And it comes amid a massive withdrawal effort at Kabul's airport, at least through today, with a number of countries jostling still to get their people out of the country ahead of the deadline. Macias says the Kremlin's diplomats have insisted the U.S. should not shift responsibility for Afghanistan's collapse onto others. Its state-owned media, that is Russia's, have sought to portray the departure of American troops from Afghanistan as a significant coup. Although I don't believe it is by any stretch, although try telling that in the coming months to Afghan women and children who've grown into early adulthood with a glimpse of what life could be like there, not living under suppressive Sharia-like laws. Repressive. More recently, however, the tone appears to have shifted. Putin has previously said it's critical for the Taliban to not allow terrorists to enter Afghanistan or its neighboring countries. But Mallison warns it's going to be much harder than the Russians make it out to be. Even if the Taliban keep their promises to the Russians, they'll be having to deal with much more asymmetric warfare. Now, that's because the crisis comes when many Central Asia countries are at their lowest ebb, with disenfranchised populations all over the region. Plus, there's the ongoing pandemic and extremely severe drought conditions. Moscow has already reinforced its military base in Tajikistan, a country that shares an 843-mile border with Afghanistan, where it's conducting a month's worth of military exercises. Now, to just visualize how big 843 miles is, well, simply picture California's coastline. It's vast and makes Afghanistan vulnerable to penetration at a number of fronts, although some of the mountainous regions do make that problematic. But the Kremlin says it's learned the lessons of the former Soviet Union's own failed intervention in Afghanistan in the 1980s and won't send armed forces there, particularly in military conflict. I say that remains to be seen. Indeed, sending some troops, especially its special forces, could be tempting, particularly if Xi Jinping keeps China forces out of the country and focused on Taiwan, Hong Kong, and the South China Sea for now. But make no mistake, Putin and his generals have got to be pleased about the egg running down the face of the U.S. right now, even if they're nervous at the same time. Mallinson points out that Russia fears an uncontrollable flow of refugees, as well as groups that might attack them. Of course, from Afghanistan, especially with suicide bombers hiding among literally tens of thousands of refugees. Olga Oliker at the International Crisis Group believes if Taliban leaders can maintain stability and don't let Afghanistan become a base for attacks on Russia and Central Asia, then Russia can live with it. But things could go badly, especially if the Taliban can't control the production of poppies and the flow of opium out of that country. In that case, Russia will be looking to reinforce Central Asia as needed. Moreover, so could the U.S. Will America's impatience with rising opioid overdose deaths result in its war of drugs taking a new turn? And would a ramped up overseas efforts to stem the inflow of heroin and its sisters make it difficult or even impossible to really end the war in Afghanistan? Poppies are a huge source of income for the Taliban. The Taliban nationally in Afghanistan and a number of regional Taliban tribes or groups. It could certainly complicate things unless official U.S. drug policy fundamentally shifts away from a war on drugs toward treatment and prevention. In any event, terrorists walking among masses over there, seeking asylum in particular, is a Pandora's box. I mean, one of Afghan's neighbors, Tajikistan, again, has pledged to take in up to 100,000 refugees. It's working with the UN and other NPOs to establish camps and other safe and sanitary facilities as the humanitarian crisis further develops. Other experts expect Russia to boost its already large military presence in Tajikistan and even extend it to Uzbekistan. Most Central Asian states is being worried that Putin could use the threat of Islamist insurgency to push Russia's Eurasian Union idea. That's centralizing European Union-like agenda that Putin has actually been pushing. I mean, think Belarus. The Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS for short, is a regional loose-knit organization of 9 of the 15 former Soviet republics in Eurasia. Massia says Russia may increase pressure on those countries to join the Eurasian Economic Union. That's Putin's scheme that already includes Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. As Melody said earlier in the show, a lot going on behind the scenes we don't know about. This is one of them. And I believe it points to ramped up geopolitical uncertainty in an already volatile part of the world. And you know what that means. For the price of gold and silver. Okay. Again, investors cheered Jerome Powell's Much Ado About Nothing Jackson Hole speech on Friday, as we talked about in the first segment, or second, I believe, with markets interpreting it to mean that the Fed won't be winding down its support of the economy too quickly after all. But not every speaker at the annual gathering gave cause for optimism. Take Don Cohn, the Fed's former vice chair for financial supervision. He used his speaker slot to instead warn of imminent risks to the stability of the global financial system. He told the attendees that dealing with risks to the financial stability is urgent. The current situation is replete with unusually large risks of the unexpected. He added that if they should come to pass, they could result in the financial system amplifying shocks, putting the entire global economies at risk. Cohn pointed to the minutes of the Federal Open Market Committee's July meeting, which indicated that members saw notable vulnerabilities in the financial system, particularly as asset values have risen to historic highs and government and private debt have reached record levels or near record levels, particularly as a percentage of GDP. Despite these excesses, however, he said investors don't appear concerned, as evidenced by low interest rates on a wide range of government and corporate debt. What's more, Cohn said, as we've been saying on this program, the government appears to be in a poor position to respond to an economic downturn that could result from the bursting of an asset bubble or a debt crisis. Cohn's wariness about the state of the economy and financial markets is shared among many high-profile investors. One of them, GMO co-founder Jeremy Grantham, argued in June that the Fed should act to deflate all asset prices as carefully as it can, knowing that an earlier decline, however painful, would be smaller and less dangerous than waiting. Unlike other bubble watchers like Grantham, however, Cohn's not laying the blame for high debt and asset prices at the feet of Fed policy. Rather, he's arguing that the Fed must prepare now for a potential bubble bursting through tighter bank regulation. He believes the lack of enough regulation on banks could be the pin that bursts the bubble. One strategy, he said, would be to require major banks to fund themselves with less debt and more equity, in the form of retained earnings or money raised from stockholders. It's a good idea. The Fed's so-called counter-cyclical capital buffer enables the regulator to modify how much debt banks are able to take on, decreasing the level in good times when banks can really afford to do so. Raising capital requirements during boom times like these could put a brake on runaway asset prices. Cohn urged the Fed to increase the countercyclical capital buffer, and I couldn't agree more. That's something that Randall Quarles, the Fed's current vice chair for financial supervision, has resisted doing, saying that raising the buffer would needlessly reduce the ability of banks to provide credit to their customers. Tisk, tisk, tisk. Now, lastly, Linda Kahn, new chair of the Federal Trade Commission, has told the White House she plans to probe mergers of retail gasoline stations to avert potentially anti-competitive behavior that could drive up the cost of gas. Her August 25th letter is a move spurred on by the administration concerns that the rising price of gasoline would curtail an economic recovery. Well, it's certainly a good time for the optics, anyway, of taking on rising prices. As of last week, gas prices had already climbed about 50% in less than a year to $3.15 per gallon, up from $2.10 in November of last year. Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. Melody and Butch will be here tomorrow. I'll be back on Thursday. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks for listening to Financial Survival. And please, be safe out there. Bye-bye. That's too bad.